This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. When we were kids, animals probably taught us some about life. Wasn't it the three bears who show this while some things are too hot and some too cold? One thing could be just right. And with the tortoise and the hare, it was steady and constant that won the race. Of course, those were fairy tales. So how about in the real world? Does monogamy among penguins mean it's good for humans too? Altruism among bats proof of the right way to go? Well then, what about slavery among ants? A Virginia-based researcher has been investigating 200 years of nature stories used to teach human ethics. His conclusion? Different interest groups have been trying to use nature for what he calls a kind of ventriloquism. We ask science historian Nicholas Rubke to explain that and invite you to share your ideas about where ethics should come from right after the news. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. Ethics, morality, and the use of stories about animals to justify human behavior is our focus today. And you are most welcome to join the conversation at 888-WMRA Talk. That's 888-967-2825. Today's guest, while working at universities and research centers around the world, has spent much of the past 40 years studying the history of science. He just recently signed on as the Johnson Professor of History at Washington and Lee University. Nicholas Rubke, welcome to the Insight Studios.
Well, thanks for inviting me to be here.
Well, Dr. Rubke, I understand that you have much to tell us about the different political or religious and even morality watchdog groups who have been using stories on nature in some fascinating ways over the past 200 years and the implications that you see in this trend for questions about ethics and human behavior in our own world today. But I'd like to start, if I could, with some of the different animal and even insect behaviors that have become the basics of morality tales, because I think there are some of these that are going to surprise people.
Yeah.
So very first, can you tell me about ants engaging in slavery?
Ooh, dear, there you start with something that's very time-bound, too. Because, you see, what as an historian I do, very different from philosophers, theologians, biologists, scientists in general, is that we look at a time perspective and we see what these guys have done over time and in different places. And you see, and that is the amazing thing, the issue of animal behavior and human morality emerges around 1800 when we get these guys professionalized. They start studying insects and all the rest. But then there are these different periods of political history when people focus on wholly different issues. You know, there's the revolutionary period of nationhood building in the 19th century, then later in the 19th century, the empire period, then in the 20th century, wars, World War I, World War II, and now, of course, the Pax Americana, the great period of American domination of Western culture. Now, in all these periods, you see wholly different fascinations with animal behavior to justify our human morality. And in the early part of the 19th century, there's the nationhood building. Also in America, many Europeans look to America for republicanism and say, look at ants. Ants aren't monarchies. Bee societies are these dreadful class-ridden bee societies. But ants are republics, like in that wonderful New America, or in Europe, just Switzerland. But then, of course, in America, you get the North and the South problem. You get the abolition problem. And what do you see? People who study these ant societies, who had been saying, hey, let's look at these armies, now say, yeah, but what about slavery among ants? Because some Frenchmen discovered some myrmecologists that are experts on ants.
A myrmecologist is an ant expert. Okay.
Good. Absolutely. They discovered that some ant societies had developed slavery, you know, taking other ants from other colonies to make them work for them doing that damn, you know, daily hard, sorry for the word, for their hard work.
So, now, wait a minute. Sometime around 1800, there's a biologist in France who is studying ants, and he does indeed prove that at least certain species of ants engage in slavery.
Absolutely. A little later than 1800.
And what did he find? He found that they captured ants from other colonies?
Absolutely.
And what did they make those captured ants do?
Gosh, it's, you know, the work that's done by the workers. So, you see, of course, that there is a kind of class society developing after all. As you have in bees, you have the workers, you have the drones, you have the queen bee, and so on. You have a class society.
Do I recall from what you've said before that one of the things they found in ant slaves is they made the ant slaves chew up pieces of leaf and carry them back to the colony to feed their masters?
Absolutely. That kind of thing, gosh, don't ask me the details exactly of what this particular Frenchman at that time. I would have to go back to my sources. But yes, along those lines, absolutely.
And that's it. And then bees were used by some political groups around the same time to say that rule by divine right, rule of royalty or monarchy was a good thing?
No, it was a bad thing. Absolutely. So, yes, of course, in Britain they were arguing, gosh, don't look at these animal societies, these bees as an example, because it would undermine us Anglican monarchists in Britain trying to push back the French Revolution
but all these movements. Bees did have a monarch. Bees obey a queen, so they have
absolutely
a monarch.
Okay.
So why is that a bad thing?
Well, so the first person to write explicitly a detailed book about this connection between bee society and human politics was a German materialist who was involved in trying to unify Germany. Freiheit und Einheit was the German word, so freedom and unity. So against monarchy and against also the church, a unified German nation, which later came with Bismarck. And so this guy was deeply involved and was a revolutionary and was expelled and had to flee to Switzerland and all the rest of it. He wrote this wonderful monograph using bee societies to say how bad monarchies are. Look at these slave labor bees.
Ah, and since then the queen forced the bees to work, that was proof that having a royal government was bad.
Yeah, and the drones, you know, that's the class of the Junkers, you know, the elite nobility that all lived. So the queen and the drones, they all lived off these workers. And so that's how he described bee society.
And yet,
did experiments with them in political terms. It was extraordinary. And he did this in 1848-49. That is the time of the great revolutionary moment across the European continent to establish nationhood across much of Europe, where little principalities and little monarchies and all the rest of it had divided Europe. So Italy, Germany, other parts.
And now we talked about ants and slaves, but was this around the same time period that some people were celebrating ants because they believed that ants practiced some form of democracy?
Oh, absolutely. But that comes slightly later.
But what did the ants do that was a democratic impulse?
They didn't have the same kind of sort of three-class system, like, you know, royalty and then upper class, and then working class, you know, which was known from Britain. Gosh, the Americans at the moment have such difficulty. They always talk about middle class, and really they mean working class. But okay, good. So they saw this, you know, this triple class division from Britain reflected into bees, in bee society.
Uh-huh.
And didn't see it in ant society, which seemed more egalitarian, more Republican. So they said, this reflects the new Republicanism from America. So they adored America.
It seems to me that
was only Switzerland. Okay, go on.
That in preparing for our get-together today, Dr. Nicholas Rupke, that I read somewhere that there'd been some research that ant scouts go out to look for places for new colonies, to where the ants, new ant families might move next. And that there, some biologists believe that they bring news back of locations that different scouts favor, and that the colony in essence votes on it, that the number of ants who go and like the one location, the largest number, that's the location that everybody moves to. Does that sound correct to you? Because that certainly does sound like ants practicing democracy.
Quite. Yes, but now you're skipping almost a century. So that kind of sophistication in myrmecology and in ant research didn't exist at that time yet, when there was this this period in Europe of revolution and nationhood building. That used that period, some of these figures, like Vogt and Büchner, let me just name two very specific names who wrote big books on this, they used bees and ants to push their materialism, their revolutionary republicanism, their anti-monarchism, and their anti-church policies. Then, of course, much later, today, good heavens, there's the great myrmecologist at Harvard, E.O. Wilson, who's just published a book on the extraordinary developments in ant society and in human society in conquering the earth. There, of course, more details come in, as you just mentioned.
He is the former director of Germany's Göttingen Institute for the History of Medicine, as well as former director of the Göttingen Institute for the History of Science. Today, he serves as the Johnson Professor of History at Washington and Lee University. Nicholas Rupke is our guest. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. We're taking a look at Dr. Rupke's latest studies about animal behavior and human morality, the workings of an upcoming book that he is going to be publishing. If you have a question or comment for him, you can reach us at 888-WMRA-TALK. Or take the route that Carolyn took and post to us on Facebook, where we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. So, Nicholas, here's two posts from Carolyn, back-to-back. Humans are not nearly civilized enough to emulate nature, she says. Nature takes only what it needs to survive. Not an uncommon view today? No. An accurate view?
No. Yeah, you see, I think increasingly in our days, and this, I think, comment reflects that, we use animal behavior and human morality studies in a way to push animal rights. We see in gorillas, in chimpanzees, in other animals, human features, not just intelligence, but in particular also feelings, empathy, other things that emphasize a commonality, a relatedness that pushes the cause of biodiversity preservation, like E.O. Wilson does, and also animal rights that Peter Singer does. E.O. Wilson at Harvard, Peter Singer at Oxford. So these are reputable people, good colleagues, who push these causes, and I actually support them in that, I think. But what my argument as an historian is, it's that through history, through the past 200 years, you see that this relationship of animal behavior and human morality changes according to the political and geographical places where these issues are discussed.
I've understood that you, in describing this phenomenon that started a little bit more, you say, than 200 years ago.
Quite.
As using nature for a kind of ventriloquism. So I want to ask you to explain that, invite our audience to join in with their ideas about what they think they've learned from animals or where they think they've learned ethics and morality. But we have to pause first for a 1-minute break. Nicholas Rubke is a former marine geologist who many years ago switched his field of research to the history of science. He has held professorships at Göttingen University in... I'm saying that wrong. Göttingen.
Göttingen, perfectly pronounced.
Göttingen University in Germany and Vanderbilt University here in the U.S. He's also held numerous prestigious fellowships around the world, the Smithsonian, Oxford, and the Australian National University Institute, just to name a few. Now, just a few months ago, Dr. Rupke accepted an offer to join the faculty at Washington and Lee University in Lexington, Virginia, as that school's Johnson Professor of History. So what do you, who are listening, think about the idea of using nature to explain how humans should or should not behave? Can you think of a story about animal behavior that taught you a lesson on morality? What do you think about using animal stories to teach others ethics or even to promote a particular point of view? 888-WMRA-TALK is how to reach us by phone. That's 888-967-2825. On Facebook, you can find us listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. Ventriloquism. Tell me about that.
Well, the thing is this. You see, it seems very compelling looking at animals and then human behavior once you accept commonality. Before the 19th century, most people believed in a kind of so-called Cartesian Christian dualism, whereby animals were one thing, instinct machines, and humans shared the bodies of animals, but not their mind. The mind was a divine direct ray from heaven into them, you know.
So before 1800, the whole idea of humans behaving in a way similar to animals was a bad idea. That
absolutely.
We were supposed to be separate and better than animals.
Absolutely. If anything, animal behavior was just used as an allegory, like, you know, the cycad and the ant, that story by La Fontaine, and also in the Bible, you know, Solomon uses examples like that. But that wasn't compelling, you see. Those were just allegories. And to a certain extent, if anything, it was the other way around. There were even... court cases where animals were judged by human morality. Pigs who had might have killed on a farm by accident a person would be brought into court to be judged and killed. But that changes through the 19th century when materialists and later evolutionists, Darwinians, say no, humans and animals, there is a commonality that makes their behavior, animal behavior, relevant, enlightening, compelling even, or justifying, even legally justifying, of human behavior. And so first that was in the period of a revolution about institutions of politics. Then in the empire period, you know, later in the 19th century, gosh, it has to do with, especially with institutions of civilization, the institution of marriage, and so on. Then around 1900,
wait a minute,
and on
wait,
and on.
Before you go, tell me about what animals had to do with the institution of marriage.
Absolutely. Because you see, this is still the Victorian period where people really wanted to talk about sex, but didn't dare to. So there were whole books, big monographs, written by Brits, by Continentals, by Americans on this issue. Treating of animal behavior in terms of love, but love, quote, unquote. So love was dealt with at that time still in terms of marriage, love of country, love of siblings, love of whatever,
but
not
tell,
sex,
tell me,
but they wanted to.
They wanted to talk
and
about sex.
And then it broke out around 1900, I tell you.
And what did they say animals did that made it okay for humans, or humans should emulate what animals were doing?
Yeah, here's my point, you see. So, wherever you are, whether Britain, more Anglican, more Christian, or Germany, more secularized, with materialist philosophers dominating, or France, even worse, quote-unquote. Gosh, this is not my judgment. Huh? I'm talking about how these people wrote about each other. So, It all depends where you are, what they do. So in Britain, certain animals get selected. In France, some others.
Okay, but give me some specifics. Which animals get selected, and what is it the animal does that makes part of the argument?
Now, at this time, it's very clear. It's the usual Victorian examples of the domineering male, the polygamist, you know.
Horses are used as an example?
Yes, you know, lions often too, you know, and sea lions.
And the idea is that the male lion has a whole harem.
Absolutely. That's the thing. So if that's natural, if God allows that, well, why shouldn't the Mormons have that go at it all, you know? So
Did the Mormons use that argument? Do you know?
Oh, you're pushing me a little bit too far now, because this would get us into contemporary politics. I stay away from this,
for
the moment. But yes, a very interesting issue you are raising there.
Science historian Nicholas Rubke is our guest. So if he's not going to allow me to push him, I'm sure he would let you get away with it. And we do have some phone lines open at 888-WMRA-TALK. But most of our comments and questions are coming in on Facebook so far. So let's go now to Michael, who says, I wonder if Dr. Rubke is familiar with beecollective.org. They are a graphic design collective that use insect imagery as a metaphor for anti-capitalistic activists. The images are very rousing and are all about ethics.
Well, I'm not familiar with this particular example, but I'm familiar with similar examples. And indeed, I'm very familiar, and this is the very basis of my work I'm doing, with the fact that we seem to be, through our respect for science, so willing to use scientific studies, studies of nature, studies of animal behavior, to legitimate or even provide a compelling moral basis for our behavior. And my basic argument, maybe I should just briefly formulate it at this
Before
point.
Before you do, one of the producers just sent me a note that, in case anybody wants to look this up, that I mispronounced what Michael had written or misread it. It's actually beehivecollective.org. Hopefully nobody's going to go away from the conversation to their computer right now anyway, but beehivecollective.org for after the show if you want to look it up.
I certainly shall.
And part of the argument that you are making is that at different points in time, in different places, people have in essence used nature to make exactly opposite arguments.
Yeah, or at least different. If not opposite, at least different. Always suiting themselves. Now, the scientists...
So does that prove that using animals is not...
Here we get into a difficulty. So the scientists, they get worked up when I say these things. And they say, are you accusing us of not doing accurate work? Of course I'm not. They do beautiful work. They do accurate work. But it is the fact that they ask particular questions and use particular subjects at particular times that...
So that's what you call ventriloquism.
Which, indeed,
you're making nature say what you want it to say.
Absolutely. Which, if you look at it in his historical perspective, you see that in the 19th century, early 19th century, the materialists find examples that speak in support of republicanism against the monarchy. In the late 19th century, these animals speak in support of colonialism and empire. And
it would help me a great deal if you could give examples of which animals are being used because they do what thing.
Ah, but now you're making it a little bit complex. I can go into the 20th century and do that. But when I speak about empire, we get into a different issue. And it was very, very shocking. Let me mention that to you all the same, very briefly. But you see, who's an animal? This is the issue that emerged after Darwin, in Darwinism, in British imperialism in the late 19th century. And instead of just looking at gorillas and chimpanzees, they decided that basically, in support of the theory of evolution, savages were essentially animals. So there were these wonderful studies, and I must say they were brilliant, don't get me wrong, but morally shocking, of native peoples in Canada, in North America, in Australia, and so on and so on and so on, you know, where they treated these natives, these so-called savages, essentially as animals. And so the entire boundary between animals and humans was shifted to beyond the savages, making them animals, looking at the happens as animal behavior and making it possible to move in, shoot them, move them out of their territories, eradicate them like any other group of animals. It was shocking, and it was done by very nice people in Britain and on the continent. So this whole animal behavior, human morality thing, and let me just mention one name, very nice guy, John Lubbock, great Darwinian. He did this in a number of books, and it had great consequences in Canada, in North America, in Australia. These natives, these so-called savages, became regarded as animals, studied as animals, and their behavior was seen in contrast to civilized behavior as animal behavior and legitimated extermination. Dreadful stuff. So these studies are of real political consequences.
Attitude that you're talking about. What we're talking about, the 1700s, the early
1800s? No, late 19th century, the age of empire, after the age of revolution.
So this was the same kind of argument that was used in America and some other places in the world about people who were brought by force from Africa, that they were considered Negroes, they were considered slaves, they were considered
absolutely
animals.
Absolutely. The whole abolition thing here joins the native peoples thing.
Well, don't you see some irony in this? That during this 100-year period, you've got, on the one hand, taking human beings and classifying them as animals so that then you can treat them in any way that's convenient for you without any sense of guilt or immorality because they are not human.
Absolutely.
And on the other hand, you have people making arguments about ants being good because they practice democracy, so the rest of us should practice democracy.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because the ants were older. They'd had more experience. Some of the guys said that quite literally. They said, these ants have been around for much longer, so we should listen to them. Look at them. Take that example. And this then, but let us continue now, just briefly,
well,
not sticking to these horrific
stuff. For the sake of anybody who's just joined us, this is Virginia Insight, and our guest is science historian Nicholas Rubke. And also to you listening in, I'd be interested in hearing your view on this question. If not from the natural world, where do you think our morals should come from? Should it be religion? Leaders and role models? Trendsetters? Your own inner voice? Comic book superheroes? Someplace else? We do have a phone line open for you at 888-967-2825. I have another Facebook question here, but I can hold it for a moment if you want to go ahead with what you're saying. Okay.
No, yeah, as you wish.
No, well, please.
No, I wanted to say, let's not just get stuck in the 19th century, however exciting that is as a period in this particular relationship of animal behavior and human morality. Then in the 20th century, of course, there are the world wars, the two world wars, and people get enormously preoccupied about pacifism, war, aggression, territoriality, and try to understand how these so-called civilized Europeans, who had been exterminating natives as savages and animals in the late 19th century and were continuing to do that up to a point in the 20th, could start killing each other. How could that be? And their animal behavior studies again helped out. And you see,
Is this at the point where looking at certain animals, there was an observation that they were very territorial and that if their territory was threatened, they tended to get aggressive and in fact, war amongst each other?
Absolutely.
And are there particular animals, again, that were used for this argument.
Absolutely, but then more...
No, but what were the animals, do you know?
Well, wolves, for example.
Okay.
You see, but more importantly, what was done, especially...
See, but the problem I have is, if you don't tell me which animals were being used for which arguments, I have trouble creating a picture in my mind.
Fair enough.
Okay.
So, for the social institutions, it tends to be insects. But when we get to this territoriality, we are dealing largely with mammals. Wolves, for example, but other mammals as well. And at this time, too, animal behavior studies, ethology it's now called in the 30s and 40s, becomes a really prestigious biological study and gets its first Nobel Prizes. Lorenz, Tinbergen, von Frisch, those three. And what they are concerned with is aggression and territoriality. Where does it come from? And Lorenz specifically, very clearly, gosh, the guy had a bit of a Nazi background, as has recently been revealed. There we are. Sorry to have to mention this. But you see, so they now deal with saying, how come we civilized Europeans had these two most dreadful world wars killing each other?
And the answer is that animals did it like wolves, so it's understandable that humans would do it.
Well, yes, but then
I got to stop you there, because we got questions from the audience.
Okay, fair enough.
So this is Riley in Harrisonburg who's joined us by phone. Riley, thank you for doing that. Your question or comment for science historian Dr. Nicholas Rupke, please.
Hello. Well, you asked about where we think our morals should come from.
Mm-hmm.
And then a couple minutes ago, we talked about the Mormons. And so I thought it'd be interesting, just for the information of the conversation, I am a Mormon, and polygamy in the animal world was actually not an official doctrinal support for the church behavior, though it might have been a reconciliation for some church members. But like I said, I'm a Mormon, and so I think that our morality should come from a religion, or if somebody isn't religious, that their personal morality does stem from some, well, I mean, that we're, you know, children of divinity, in my opinion.
Well, I'm very sympathetic to this position, actually, because however much of a scientist I am myself, and an historian of science, it is the historical perspective that shows me the extraordinary relativity of scientific claims to being able to establish a basis for human morality. So I do think it has to come from somewhere else. I myself come from a very Christian background. My father was a church minister and so on. But I can see too, you know, even if you get these extremely materialistic, anti-religious, Darwinian scientists, like Richard Dawkins, it's obvious then that when he then proclaims at some stage in his books morality, it's the morality of his Anglican background. The boy grew up in an Anglican background.
So when Riley says that it is his view that morality should come from religion, you're disagreeing with that? Where do you think it should come from?
No, I'm not disagreeing. I'm saying that that's where it does come from in nearly all instances, and that we use that morality we grow up with. E.O. Wilson was a Baptist, don't forget. You know, Dawkins an Anglican, and on we go. You know?
Riley, thank you so much for the clarification about Mormon teachings and for sharing your perspective on where ethics and morality should come from. Appreciate you taking the time to call us. Hoping that anybody else who has a perspective they want to share will be feeling free to join in when we get back from the break. The number, 888-WMRA-TALK. Born in Holland, the son of a conservative, creationist, Calvinist minister, Nicholas Rupke has traveled the world, first studying marine geology, then the history of science. Most of his previous books have been biographies of significant figures from the world of science, but now he is writing one about the topic we've been discussing this hour. His working title is Animal Behavior and Human Morality in Human Perspective, but Dr. Rupke says he's open to suggestions for a zingier heading for his new book. So if you have one, you're welcome to make that suggestion at 888-WMRA-TALK. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Craig from Grados, thanks for calling in. Your question or comment, please.
This is a fascinating discussion. So if we look to animals to possibly be a basis of our morality, and yet some animals mate for life, like I believe loons, eagles, and so forth, and some don't, and some are male dominant, and some species are female dominant, do you just choose which animals you agree with? I'm just curious how that might work.
Well, absolutely. That's such a good question. That's one of the points I'm trying to make from my historical studies, that you see that through history, depending on time, on place, on predilections, on sensibilities, and so on, people choose particular features in order to reconfirm the values they've grown up with in the first place. That's why I've said, you know, there is a kind of ventriloquism going on, you know, nature being put on the lap of the scientist, and it's made to speak what the scientist likes to hear. For example, let's just take gorillas or chimpanzees. You know, in the 19th century, these were treated as these horrible monsters, you know, that led to King Kong and the whole Hollywood industry about it. But what do we have now is this wonderful British lady, Jane Goodall, who's trying to, you know, prevent the extermination of these creatures. She lives with them and treats them like almost fellow humans, almost creatures she herself could marry, for all I know. You know, you see these pictures kissing her. So it's
based in part on what Craig was saying.
Yeah,
I wonder if you can also tell us about bonobos and the argument that's being used about.
Yes.
They're a kind of chimpanzee, right?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, this is the work of my fellow Dutchman, Frans de Waal. You know, I'm very proud of him. He's come from Holland, like I have, across the Atlantic to America.
I know, but you got to tell me about what it is bonobos do that certain political organizations in the war themes believe is what shows something about what humans should do.
Right. Well, what Frans has been able to do in great detail is show a kind of empathy, like not just, you see, early on the issue was, do animals have intelligence? Do they have rationality? Do they have a human minds?
What is it that bonobos do that people want us to do?
Quite. So these days we are saying no, but do they have human feelings? And it's the feelings, the being able to suffer or to empathize or all those things that have become crucial. And, of course, that is what Frans has been able to show. And that's been very supportive in the cause of gender equality issues, the importance of so-called feminine values.
So bonobos practice a kind of gender equality and they value empathy?
Well, yeah, that's putting it a little bit simply, but yes, okay, I'm going to say yes to that. Yes, that's what the issue is.
Craig, thank you so very much for your call. Is it Castillo?
Hello?
Is that how I pronounce your name, Castillo?
Costo Constantine.
Okay, your question or comment for Dr. Rubke, please.
Yeah, I wonder, for people that didn't grow up in with a religious background, where does morality come from?
Excellent point, of course. And religious people will have almost no answer to that. They'll tell you just to revert to their particular beliefs and take advice from metaphysical, from sources from higher up. But of course, scientists will say, well, these things come from survival strategies. Like, if you are altruistic, you survive better, you do better, and so on. So that's what they argue. Now, once again, here I am comparing animal behavior and human morality and say that the scientific position, the materialist position, so to speak, is weak because it tends to see in nature, in natural processes, even in, you know, the selfish gene or whatever, a theory of evolution, a basis that is time and place bound and cannot lay claim to any universality, which is what we like to see below, beyond, you know, supporting our moral values.
Do you have an answer to your own question by chance?
No, I kind of heard partially the answer, but I think I'm okay with it.
I was just curious if your thought, if someone was not religious, where their morality would come from.
I think the society has a lot of impact in the morality of the people that live in that society. So that's, for instance, I'm originally Eastern European, and living in a communist system, they didn't necessarily emphasize a lot on religion, yet, we grew up to be quite moral, and that's my point.
Costa, thank you so much for joining us here on Virginia Insight.
Excuse me, Lenny, can you repeat, because I didn't hear the question.
I just said thank you for taking the time to join
us. Yes, thank you.
So to you on the other side of your radio, if you are a parent, have you ever used a story about animal behavior to teach your kids some important lesson? After listening to today's guest, are you more or less likely to do that in the future? 888-WMRA-TALK is our phone number, 888-967-2825. Or if you prefer to type instead of talk, you can reach us on Facebook, where we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. Nicholas, talking about the difference between morality coming from religion or morality coming from this ventriloquism of nature, as you've called it, depending on time and place and who's making the argument. There is this biblical instruction, certainly for the Judeo-Christian ethic, that says, honor thy father and thy mother. I'm curious if you're aware that any similar type of argument has ever been made because of what some group of animals do in the wild.
Gosh, you ask very pertinent questions. In all truth, I'm not aware of that. Maybe combining your question with the last comment of questioner, you see, there are these values in society. He mentioned society in general. He says, "Oh, it comes from society." Well, absolutely, it does. But let's not forget that is a collective morality we derive from our religious institutions. Now, gosh, don't push me any further. You know, can I justify this? Can I find a basis, a permanent basis for that? I'm not sure.
It but sounds to me like maybe what you're saying is that religious institutions for so long have had so much influence on an overall society that one doesn't have to be a member of an individual religion, that the society as a whole that's teaching you about ethics and morality will have been influenced in the past based on religion?
Yeah, but basically what I want to argue is that science is a poor source of morality, and that basically so much of what's happening in science, what science is doing, science and medicine, its power is so considerable, its consequences are so enormous, it needs to be kept at a moral leash in society, and that morality is not provided by society, by science itself, but has to come from other sources. And up till now, I'm afraid, from religious institutions, however imperfect so many of them at times seem to be. That's my particular view.
I think we have time for one more call. Steve in Harrisonburg, thank you for joining us on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment, please, for science historian Nicholas Rubke.
Yes, I come from a religious tradition that rejects violence almost in any circumstance, whether it's self-defense or, in other situations. And I was wondering if there were examples in the natural world that would support a pacifist.
Oh, yes, absolutely. So there was a great Swiss ant expert called Henri Forel, and he was one of the founders of the League of Nations, which was a precursor of the United Nations.
And let me
after World War
One, did you say this was an expert on ants?
Ants, absolutely. Okay. A myrmecologist, an expert on ants. And he used ants in particular to argue against war and for pacifism and for a United Nations, not of only, of North America, with all these states being united into one republic, but of the world.
How do you do that if in the past ants have been used to talk about justifying slavery?
Well, there you go. That's the thing. Now we get back again to my ventriloquism. You see what I mean? The guy was a great example. Gosh, just at the same time, that was a Jesuit priest, Wassmann. And he, of course, used these termites. He was a termite expert. To justify Catholic orders and celibacy, saying, gosh, look, termites.
Termites are celibate?
Just about, yes, indeed.
Some of them. Obviously not all of them.
Well, yes. Quite, yes.
Steve, that was such a great question. Thank you so much. It seems to me, Nicholas Rupke, that one of the underlying points, one of the reasons after your career of more than 40 years of researching science, that you are focusing on this now and writing a book about this is because you want to challenge the idea that we should automatically give authority to science?
Or nature, yes. I think nature, people say nature carries authority for our moral behavior. That basically means science does. It's not just that nature speaking to us. It speaks through science. That means scientists. And can they do it? My conclusion from the history of science is that they do it according to times, to places, to predilections, to interests, to their own interests, often national interests, and therefore there are no universals here to be learned from nature and science. And so we are left still in this quandary, with this conundrum, where does our morality come from? And basically what we are still pushing, most of us, is some mixture of religious wisdom.
We were talking a little earlier about bonobos, and it seems to me that I read something in preparing for meeting with you today, Nicholas, that said one of the things that's being recognized about this kind of chimpanzee is that women the female bonobos have a great deal of authority. Can I take it from what you're saying that in our world today, then it's not automatic that women ought to have more authority just because bonobos do?
Excellent question. Just exactly, you know, there is this conundrum. To what extent do bonobos, when they seem to support gender equality, give us legitimation or even more for doing it in our society or not? Gosh, you can take another one. You could go worse, you know. Some feminists have taken praying mantises as examples, where, you know, the female eats the male after copulation and says, you know, there you go, you guys. But could that be a moral a moral rule for us in human society?
I have
clearly,
no idea,
I'd say,
but we're almost out of time, so I'm gonna turn to Nancy, who's been waiting on the line to ask what will probably be the final question. Nancy, thank you for joining in.
Well, I was just wondering, I once knew a black cat, Ebenezer, who was very well-mannered, and I was thinking of writing a book about Ebby answering questions about manners for children, because he didn't scratch on the furniture, he waited his turn, he was a delightful cat.
Well, why not do that? I strongly encourage you to do that, that's wonderful, but I think the compellingness of it lies in the allegory of it. I don't think in any sort of deep moral obligation for us to follow that example. But wonderful, gosh, I'll buy the book. Go for it.
Well, we, with our fundraisers, sometimes have pet days where people call in to make contributions. And they can do it for any pet, a tortoise, a snake, a bird, but mostly it's cats and dogs. And I happen to work with colleagues who are almost all cat lovers, and I'm a dog lover. I wonder, Dr. Rupke, if before you go, you can tell us whether the cat lovers or the dog lovers are right.
I side with the dog lovers. I side with you. I side with Rupert Sheldrake, you know, that extraordinary British biologist that sees in dogs all sorts of extraordinary telepathy and precognition, even helping their owners who suffer from epilepsy, warning them 10 minutes beforehand they are going to have a seizure. So I'm always the dogs because cats don't do that.
Nancy, we do love cats too. Thank you so much for your
call. Yes, I do too.
In the final 20 seconds we have left, bottom line point about using nature for morality. Do you have one you want to make?
Mine?
Yes.
I would say, let's look at it, let's be fascinated, let's not feel compelled by it. Our moral rules come from deeper sources.
Our guest has been the director, well, the former director of the History of Science Institute in Germany, now the Johnson Professor of History at Washington and Lee University, Nicholas Rubke. He's working on his forthcoming new book, tentatively titled Animal Behavior and Human Morality in Human Perspective.
In Historical Perspective.
In Historical Perspective. Well, that's even better.
Yeah.
But you're still open to suggestions for...
Quite.
You can find audio postings of Virginia Insight by going online to WMRA.org, then clicking on Programs, and then clicking on Virginia Insight. If you go to that page, you will find links to more information about the work Dr. Rubke is doing. And if you go to the Virginia Insight Facebook page and click like, you'll get access to a whole bunch more information on these broadcasts there as well. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more Insight.